Welcome to the History Today podcast. In this episode, we talk to Peter Frankopan about Silk Roads, old and new, and Matthew Lines and Catherine Fletcher discuss academia and early career researchers. Firstly, a brief mention of our October issue, which is out this week. In the cover story, Roger Crowley describes how Portugal's seafarers created an empire and stunned 15th century Europe to emerge as a major power. Also in this issue, we mark the anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt with two articles. Gwilym Dodd explains why England's unexpected success lured Henry V into pursuing a disastrous foreign policy, while Stephen Cooper looks back at how the battle's 500th anniversary resonated with Britons during the First World War. Another of the feature articles this month is by Peter Frankopan. It's called The World We Have Lost, and in it, Peter argues that history should not be viewed from an Eastern or Western perspective, but from one that links the two together. It's a fascinating approach, and early this week, Paul A. caught up with Peter via Skype to discuss his ideas in greater detail.
Peter Frankopan is Senior Research Fellow at Worcester College, Oxford, and the author of a new, highly praised book, The Silk Roads, A New History of the World, which is published by Bloomsbury. In it, Peter has applied his global vision to a fascinating article published in the October edition of History Today. It's called The World We Have Lost. Welcome, Peter.
Hello.
You open your article by pointing out just how diminished is our view, the common view, of world history. And as a consequence, our inability to even begin to understand so many of the current concerns of the modern world, rooted as they are in the past. And this seems to be an issue of chronological depth as well as geographical breadth.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, without even worrying about school curriculums, I think when one talks about people's conceptions of history, when we talk even casually amongst those who are interested in history, we look almost exclusively at the history not only of Europe, but of Western Europe. So we're all pretty well versed, I think, in events like 1066, the Romans in Britain, the Wars of the Roses, and so on and so forth. But when one starts pushing, forget about, into Central Asia along the Silk Roads and so on, even when we start getting to fairly central parts of Europe, places like Poland, Moravia, Bohemia, Croatia, etc., Poland and Ukraine, we start to lose touch. We have almost no knowledge whatsoever. I mean, Scandinavia exists purely for the blip of the Vikings. There's no engagement at all with the idea that Sweden once had a kingdom that stretched down as far as the Black Sea, or that the greatest European land empire is that of the Lithuanians. So I think that we have a mindset of how what we look at in the past is so closely tied to a set in stone narrative that I don't think you need to be over dramatic to start saying, well, you can tip the apple cart over, and perhaps there are different places to stand, not only to understand history of other regions that we don't look at, but how do the things that we focus on, how do they look from different perspectives? How does the First World War look from Persia, for example? What does global conflict mean in the 20th century? What does terrorism, what does the American intervention in the Middle East in the last decade and a half, how does that look from India and China? And those kinds of questions, I think, are things that I tried to explore in Silk Roads, try to really liberate ourselves from the confines of the well-traveled path of what history should be about. Because that history is one, it's a very common thing to say history is written by the winners, but history is written by Western Europe about Western Europe. And when it's written about other parts of the world, it's normally about Western Europe's engagement with those parts of the world.
And you seek to offer a very different vantage point here, which is that of the Silk Roads, the title of your book. So where exactly in the world are we talking here?
Well, the word Silk Road is a very sort of exotic one. It conjures up in most people's mind a sort of a route coming out of China and broadly ending up somewhere in the Mediterranean, possibly including Venice. In fact, the term was first coined in the late 19th century by Ferdinand von Richthofen, who was the uncle of the Red Baron, First World War flying ace. And he called these connections across Asia the Seidenstrassen, in plural, Silk Roads. There was no one route. In fact, there's a whole web of connections that crisscross Asia, and they go from north, south, east, west, in all directions. And of course, most people's contact and travel involvement along the Silk Roads was also very local. It didn't have to be over long distances. But so I use the concept of Silk Roads, I think, as a way of knitting in how it is that the East and West are connected to each other. And again, I think there's an awareness in the modern world that, you know, there are more scholars writing about India and about China. But that bit across the middle, how people connect, how ideas are shared, how goods, produce are exchanged, how ideas, how languages, how faiths are expressed. So it's quite an amorphous region that I'm talking about. I'm more interested in the idea of exchange across the great land masses of the world. Ultimately, I cover in my book the Americas when we get there, but from the pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar, right up to the Pacific coast of China.
And what's remarkable about the book is its chronological depth as well as this geographical breadth. And I think one of the most striking insights in it is just how irrelevant Europe is in classical antiquity. Indeed, you make the point that Rome's making is not in Western Europe, for example, the making of the Roman Empire, but in Africa.
Well, as a boy, I mean, the first person that really lit my fire, I suspect like lots of other readers and listeners, was Alexander the Great. And the question that I never understood, having been taught constantly about Western Europe, is why was it that this man who set out to conquer the world, never crossed his mind to head west? You know, this young man of deep talent, unbelievably skillful general with a very clear political touch as well. The concept of Europe was utterly meaningless to him. For ancient Greece, the prestige enemy were the Persians, and for Rome it was the same thing. And to an extent, and you can over-labor the point, but there is, to an extent, things like Asterix and Gladiator and Julius Caesar crossing over into Britain. We have this sense, I think, that we are the heirs of Rome. But I think a Roman citizen being woken up from deep sleep today would instinctively want to know what is happening in the East. And of course, in the antique period, in the period of antiquity, I think it's easy to forget also that Christianity, that great contribution that Europe's made to the world, with its flaws and its beauties as well, it's a Semitic Middle Eastern religion. Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, even Buddhism, Hinduism have important melting pots that all correspond to the center of the world, right across the Silk Roads. And I think we need to ask, I think it's an interesting question to ask, why is it that all of the language groups of the world, all of the faiths, the principal faith groups of the world, why do they all collide in the same region? And why is that region quite a long way from Europe?
And Islam, again, we find these very, very subtle shifts here in approaches to different cultures. And indeed, it's Islam that looks upon Christianity during the Middle Ages, which you detail brilliantly, as the barbarian, as the much more primitive idea.
Well, I suppose that's a very good question, and there are lots of ways one can explore that. I mean, I suppose that the most generous way is to say, well, societies that are very rich are able to indulge in cultural and intellectual patronage. So despite whatever Richard Dawkins talks about, his supposed barbarism of Muslim societies, you know, maybe the reason why Oxford and Harvard and Yale and Cambridge and these great universities all over Western Europe, they've risen over the last 400 or 500 years is because we've had the patrons and the wealth to support them. But until about 1300, by far the richest part of the world was the Islamic world, centered on the great city of Baghdad, where a superpower was born in the years following the death of the Prophet Muhammad, that eventually united a region from Spain, running across the whole of North Africa through Egypt, up as far as the Himalayas. And that wealth that streamed into the Islamic world allowed for the great minds from all over, including Christians living in these regions, to find patronage and to find an ability and an audience for ideas to be expressed. And I think in that golden age, where ideas have a premium and can be funded, you have these incredible discoveries, measuring the circumference of the world, or looking at optics, or doing what we would call today laboratory tests, to see the effects of spices, of drugs, or medicines being measured incredibly carefully, very diligently by scientists who are aware that contamination can be a problem or can skew results and that you have to repeat unusual results. And how do you explain concepts that you don't quite understand or don't seem to make sense? And I think that, again, that idea that the Christian world is the one of sophistication is one which needs to be reevaluated, because we have Masudi, the great Arab geographer, who does a description of all of the world, and he reaches Europe and he says, "Look, there's absolutely no point me wasting any space describing what I see, because there's nothing here of any importance." And to an extent, I think that that's a perfectly reasoned and even a reasonable description at that time. Things change, and I think what the scope of the book allows is to see these big rhythms running through history over a long time. And I mean, I start by saying globalization is something that is a fact of life. 500 BC, where you find rulers in China, where you find magnates and societies in Syria and so on, who are clearly communicating and borrowing ideas from each other. And I think that that accepted pathway of how we look at history that's so rooted in the present day, it's very hard to shake off. And you can only do that by reading the source materials across this big region.
Well, that's one of the really humbling things about your book is one, it's a remarkable academic feat in terms of the mastery of the sources, but also it's humbling in the sense that one realizes just how little one knows about the histories of vast parts of the world. And I'm sure that's a common reaction among many of the readers there. But I want to explore the reasons for why we ignore these things. And I think you've got three particular reasons you pick up on there. One is this narrative of the rise of the West. Two is the Western historians' commitment to specialization. Yeah. And then I think really fundamentally, you point to the lack of language skills without which this kind of history simply cannot be done.
Yeah, I think those are all, I mean, you've phrased them much better than I would, but I that's absolutely right. I mean, what's curious to me is that when we look at the topics that are very popular and sell lots of books to the wider audiences and are taught in schools, they tend to be things that have been taught and been popular for decades. I mean, I think if you took there was something I saw in the press this week about major battles in British history. And I think if you had asked the same question 100 years ago, exactly the same battles would have come up. There is the same script. And we live in a world where communication is much more rapid than it has been before, of course. But we're still teaching our children French and Spanish and Western European languages. That's if they're lucky, of course. And if they're really lucky, they might learn some Latin. And if they're in the tiny minority, they might learn some Greek. But of course, if we don't have any language skills to be able to cope with Russian or Arabic or any of the Semitic languages or Indic scripts as well and Chinese, it's very hard to be able to not just read what writers say, but understand what they mean. And those are two very distinct things. It's not just being able to read the words, but what is the author actually trying to say? And I think that is a key problem of that, you know, if you ask any of your readers in a straw poll, who is the best living Russian contemporary novelist or who is the finest modern Arabic painter, you know, our frames of reference, of recognition are so narrow. Whereas, you know, all of us can talk about, well, hopefully, could talk about opera or the top 20 in the United States, whatever it might be. We have this idea that our society leads and therefore is worthy of study. And I think you're absolutely right as well to talk about the specialization. You know, when I was dropped down the mine shaft to do my PhD, you know, those who were dropped into the mines at the same time to go and dig for jewels, you know, some had to dig extremely hard and didn't really find anything. You know, I had a friend working in a laboratory who turned out that his 600 experiments proved that, in fact, there was nothing new to show. Whereas I happened to push the doors open in the Byzantine world where I found a treasure trove that had never been touched before. And all these materials that just hadn't been read, hadn't been looked at. And I see lots of my colleagues working in increasing detail on minutiae, and it's very hard to stand back and see the bigger picture. And hopefully what I've tried to do in the book is a sort of new way of trying to look at history, where you take that academic rigor of the fine detail of individual tiny studies based on small communities in Portugal on the west coast of Africa, or the latest research on village life in late antique Syria, and try to put them into this bigger picture of trying to look out for bigger themes. So it's I suppose the book is trying to be a guide for someone who loves history, who's willing to be challenged, who's willing to be open-minded and think about things in maybe a slightly different way.
And I never like to overstate the claims of history or historians, but I do think that this book genuinely informs our contemporary world. Not necessarily in the obvious ways we might think, but the tragedies that are unfolding in parts of the regions covered by the Silk Road are very evident here and very real.
So all of your readers of The Wonderful History Today and listeners to this podcast are all people who are passionate about history and passionate above all, I think, about asking questions about the past. And what I hope that the Silk Road's book does is it encourages people not just to go and read more about particular topics they might be interested in, to think about them in different ways, but also to really recognize that studying history, not just reading about it and being engaged and interested in events that happened in the past, but to really understand the resonance and the importance of looking into the past to try to explain the world that we're living in. It's a very complex, interconnected world. But again, I think what the book shows is that interconnection, that rhythm of warfare, that rhythm of competition for resources is one that goes back millennia. So in a way, funnily enough, my editor said to me, he felt greatly relieved when he got to the end of my book, because in fact, he felt that the problems in Ukraine, the Middle East, the sort of the dislocations in China and in the Southeast, South Asian Sea, this is nothing really new that we're going through. And we can kid ourselves that everything we're facing is brand new, but that's what my children think. And I think for those of us who are able to read and able to engage with the past, using history to understand the present, there's no better time, I think, to be opening up parts of the world that just have been ignored.
Well, it certainly had the effect on me of feeling wiser and yet also more curious about the world as well. And many of the sources that you cite there, maybe largely the secondary sources you cite there, are beheading to. It's a tremendously stimulating work. And Peter Frankopan's book, The Silk Road's New History of the World, is published by Bloomsbury. And Peter's essay, The World We Have Lost, is in the October edition of History Today. Thank you very much, Peter Frankopan.
Thank you.
Thanks to Peter Frankopan and Paul Lay for that piece. Now it's over to Matthew Lyons, who spoke early this week to Catherine Fletcher about the plight of young academics.
Hello, my name is Matthew Lyons. I'm a columnist for History Today. I wrote a piece in the September issue about the problems experienced by early career researchers in the humanities generally, but particularly in history, which received quite a lot of comment and feedback on the internet and elsewhere. And Catherine Fletcher, Associate Professor of History and Heritage, wrote a very interesting blog piece in response, which was picked up by the Times Higher Education Supplement. And Catherine is here today with me to talk about issues and what perhaps can be done about them. To start off with, Catherine, how extensive do you think the problems are for early careers researchers?
Well, I think the problem stems from a sort of historical assumption that the most logical career for a PhD in history to go into is an academic career. And if you look at the numbers of academic posts versus the number of students who are now graduating with a PhD in history, the picture is not particularly rosy. So since 1994, Brodie Waddle has done some very helpful calculations on the Many Headed Monster website. Since 1994, there's been about 100% increase in the numbers of students graduating with PhDs, and only about a 20% increase in university history teaching posts, research posts. So, there's an obvious mismatch there. And I think the concern is, the other proportion of those students in history who are not going into academic jobs, are we doing enough to make sure they are supported in whatever they go on to do with their PhD? And are they going into their PhD with their eyes open and really being informed about the situation with the job market?
Yes. I mean, my impression is that there isn't a great deal of careers advice or support, and that obviously anyone who wants an academic career, you're almost certainly inclined to think that you're going to be one of the lucky ones. But, you know, there are obviously a whole range of careers in history outside of academia. But is a PhD necessarily useful for all of those?
Well, there are certainly careers outside them. In the heritage industry, I think it's fair to say that it's becoming more and more common for people to go into curatorial jobs in museums and galleries and so forth with a PhD in hand. That didn't used to be the case, but it seems to have been a bit of inflation of qualification there. Yeah. So that's more common. But there are other things that you might think, well, you know, a PhD is a great route into writing history books, and indeed it can be. Yes. But if you look at the median earnings for authors in the UK, they are not very good. I mean, something like £11,000 a year for a professional writer, and when they did a survey in 2014. So thinking that that career route is going to be a positive outcome of a PhD in history, well, you may do very well, but it's equally a gamble to an academic career. Now, there are lots of transferable skills that people with PhDs in history have. So for someone like me, whose PhD was in diplomatic history, then I could have gone into diplomatic service and gone for a civil service career doing something that was informed by my historical study. And I know people who've considered doing that. So there are lots of ways that you can take your PhD and think about applying it all across society, in policy roles in some places, international development roles, depending on the content of the PhD, there are places you can go. And universities, I think, are getting more savvy about this and more aware that they need to be providing the guidance. Yeah. But, you know, that's something that I think we've perhaps not been as quick to do as we might have been.
Looking at it from the institutional point of view, I was quite surprised. History Lab Plus did a wide survey of their members, problems with work for early career researchers, which fed into a code of conduct which they developed. And a lot of the issues on those are really very simple kind of personnel management issues, about including making sure that ECRs have access to library space, office space, but facilities they can use that they in terms of the contracts that they are paid for the time outside the specific teaching time. But, you know, it's ought to be, I think, fairly straightforward personnel management things that obviously aren't being done on a wide scale.
I think sometimes within universities, because universities have a history of being quite diverse institutions, and some of them have a lot more centralised oversight of sort of human resource functions than others. Mm. And in some of them, things have historically been very devolved to individual departments and left to heads of departments to sort out. Now, that's fine if your head of department is a person who's really on the ball and aware and engaged with that. But if they are busy, overworked, somebody with a different set of priorities, or who just hasn't been made aware in turn by their line managers and by the human resources and people centrally that they need to be ensuring that their temporary teaching staff have access to all these things, then it can be quite difficult. And I've been a trade union rep in a university, and I've seen that, you know, some departments manage these things wonderfully, and others don't do it until somebody really goes in there, puts their foot down and said, hang on a minute, why are you not doing, why are you not paying holiday pay correctly? That was something I dealt with a number of years ago. Temporary teaching staff weren't getting the holiday pay they were legally entitled to because of an oversight. Yeah. And it was corrected when I queried it. But, these things happen because university administration, in some places at least, is quite devolved to departments. So, I think early career researchers need to be, one, aware of their rights, but also prepared to go along and be quite assertive about saying, well, hang on a minute, why am I not getting this and can I have it? And asking is something they should do.
I'd be interested to know how many early careers researchers have joined the UCU, for instance, which does a lot of good work on working conditions and salary and so on.
Yes, I don't. It's certainly something that we encourage people to do. Mm. And when I was a UCU representative at the University of Sheffield, we were quite active in encouraging people on short-term contracts to join a union and to take advantage of the advice that and support it could provide. And we did a lot of casework around casual and fixed-term contracts. Mm. Not because I think Sheffield had particular problems, but because institutionally within the sector, these contracts are used a lot more than I think they should be. Mm. And as a consequence, you know, whenever you get to the end of one of these contracts, there's a whole set of issues around redeployment and whether there is space for somebody to stay within the university or not. And that, you know, it's much easier to navigate that process, I would say, if you have representation and expertise from the trade union than if you don't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the growth in PhD numbers, the exponential growth as opposed to the growth in jobs, is clearly a major factor in the problem, but also the introduction of zero-hour contracts and very short-term contracts for ECRs is another big issue. I imagine that that's university-wide policy rather than departmental.
Yeah, they're all. I mean, I think there have been casual teaching contracts in universities for a very, very, very long time. I mean, this is not something that's just sprung up in the last 10 years. Whether it's got worse or not is actually quite difficult to pin down statistically, because even if you put in a Freedom of Information request to a university about this, you will often get the reply back, we don't hold that information centrally because the hiring has been devolved to departments. Mm. So even universities don't know exactly how many casualised staff they employ. So very difficult to be precise about this. But I think one of the problems is that as there've been a greater number of history PhDs graduating, more people feel that to have a chance of an academic career in the long term, they need to take these very casualised contracts, even if the conditions are quite poor, because it's a way of keeping a foot in the door. Yeah. So there's perhaps a driver towards doing that more and more as you have a bigger pool of people competing for quite a small number of jobs.
One of the things I was struck by in the blog piece that you wrote was the idea of universities grouping together to create career structures and paths for early career researchers. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think we often tend to complain quite a lot about aren't things dreadful. And I was trying to think about a possible positive solutions that might reduce some of the instability in terms of career development for those people who do go into academic jobs. So it's important to say this is not going to be a panacea for suddenly creating more jobs. This is about stability for a group. So what I suggested was that universities who often group together and collaborate on particular issues anyway. For example, some groups of it, we have consortiums of universities that work together to provide doctoral training, might also do that with rotating early career roles where you could be guaranteed work over a period of years at one of a group of universities rather than necessarily just at one university. And that would enable people to plan their lives a little bit more. I mean, that's quite a small reform within the existing system, but it may be something that we could discuss. And I think it's important to try and get ideas out there about how we can make things better. Than they currently are.
I mean, I think perhaps part of the problem is that a lot of full-time academic staff feel very vulnerable and expose themselves in terms of their careers, and that doesn't, I suppose, in a sense, they feel quite powerless about their own positions, and therefore, by extension, they feel powerless to change things for more junior staff and for early careers staff.
Yes, I think a lot of people feel very beaten down by the system, and I think that's a problem because there's been a lot of, right since the 1990s, which was when I first worked at the university in a temporary admin job, going back then, people have said after one reform after another, we don't like grant cuts, we don't like the introduction of tuition fees, we don't like increased workload, We don't feel that the big expansion in student numbers in the 1990s was ever properly addressed in terms of the increased staffing numbers to match. Yeah. But none of that has ever, the academy collectively hasn't managed to push back very much against that big shift in the nature of universities from, say, 25 years ago. So I suppose the question then is, what, you know, are there things we can do now? Can we, you know, have a bit more of a think about what we might collectively want to change if we had to prioritise something? I think for a lot of academics, it will be workload. And that then has a knock-on effect on the number of jobs that exist. Because actually, if people only worked their official working hours, there would need to be an awful lot more people working in universities to cover the work. And even a small reduction in workload would potentially create some new positions. But I think that academics and universities need to feel a little bit more courageous and positive about saying, we're going to put forward some alternatives, and we're going to say it doesn't have to be done like this, because if we don't, then it will simply get worse and worse. And there are already voices saying, we need to push tuition fees up higher. We've got a government that's trying to introduce a teaching excellence framework, which, while I'm all in favour of providing excellent teaching, putting another level of bureaucracy and another level of monitoring and targets. Well, we've seen what that has done in the school system. And I don't think many teachers will tell you that, you know, Ofsted inspections and so forth are positive in terms of how their workload is organised. And I think we need to be very clear that this is not something that we think is going to be helpful in the university sector either.
Going back to a point you picked up earlier on, Brodie Waddell's research into the number of PhDs, I mean, should we actually discourage?
I think that, you know, most colleagues now are fairly blunt with students about the fact that one cannot expect that the normal route out of a PhD will be a route into an academic job. And if they do choose to go into a PhD, they need to think quite carefully about why they're doing it, that they're happy with the fact that what they may do is to spend 3 years doing the PhD and then go off somewhere quite laterally from that PhD rather than into an academic career. And they need to sort of familiarise themselves with the options, because in some industries, unfortunately, I'm not sure that a PhD is always looked on positively, because you can be perceived as overqualified. So people need to look around quite carefully and think about the jobs that they might like to do and what types of qualifications are typically looked for. And if they do still decide to do the PhD, because, you know, the expansion of the sum of human knowledge is a good thing and it's a fascinating thing to do, you know, to have 3 years to devote to a piece of in-depth research, that's great, but it's not a straightforward career move in the way that it might once have been.
I think that's true. And I think from someone sort of outside the academy, I think the problem with a PhD as something to have in your CV for a commercial job of some kind is inevitably a very specialist bit of research that you've done, and that may be perceived as being too niche and too specialist and less applicable than someone who has stepped back and with a more general overview of history and decided to pursue a career in TV or in publishing or whatever it might be.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the case. I think you need that PhD students who are coming to the end of their studies need to think quite carefully about how they communicate the skills that they have to future employers. And University Career Services, as I said, they're getting better at advising people on how to do this. But it is something to think about, the fact that out there may be a perception that you've spent 3 years in the ivory tower, whereas somebody else applying for the same job has spent 3 years in the real world. And unfortunately, you know, academia is often conceptualized that way in the public mind. So thinking about how to get past that impression that an employer may have is going to be quite important.
And I think also probably the assumption is, for many people outside the academy, is that if you've done a PhD, it's because you wanted a career in academia. And therefore, if you haven't got one, you may well be perceived as, in quotes, a failure.
Yes, and I think that's quite, it's quite important to try and get past the view that non-academic careers, alternative careers are second best to a career in academia.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a career in academia and I like it, and I think still think it, I would rather do this than do some other jobs, but I don't think it's a better job or, you know, in many ways than other things that people do. It is what it is. It has its downsides, it has its upsides. But I think in terms of the way that we talk about the academic job market, sometimes we do give off the sense that this is the thing that PhDs need to aim for. Yeah. And getting away from that perception, just presenting it as one of a number of options post-PhD is really important.
Mm. Yes, no, I agree. And so just pulling back to the situation of you know, people who have chosen academia as a career, you know, early career researchers, I think you know, as we've been talking, I think there's a lot that can be done to empower them, for people to empower themselves. Mm. In terms of, so for instance, the History Lab Plus Code of Conduct, mm-hmm. even if it can't be imposed to faculty by faculty, there's many things on there that individual academics can do to ameliorate the conditions of their junior staff. And as you were saying, there's many things that, that academics can collaborate on within their faculties and across the higher education sector to improve things.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Catherine.
Our thanks to Matthew Lyons and Catherine Fletcher for their time. That's all for this episode of the podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening.